Lecture 5, Consolidation, Chaos, and Terror in the Third Reich.
We had stopped in our last session with the events of 1933, a period that the Nazis referred to as the Gleichschaltung. It's another one of those numerous German words that translate very poorly. It's often translated as coordination, but in fact what it means is bringing things into line, bringing the various institutions of government into line, bringing various social institutions into line, on line with Nazi organization. The NSDAP in early 1933, as you'll recall, had been absolutely convinced that they were going to confront a revolution. They were convinced that the communists, in particular, would rise in opposition to the new regime. They were prepared to fight a civil war. And many of the actions they took in early 1933 clearly suggest that they anticipated very, very serious trouble indeed. What they discovered, however, was that using the sorts of methods that we talked about yesterday, the step-by-step, pseudo-legal preparation for each of their actions, that in fact, the Gleichschaltung had gone extraordinarily smoothly. The Nazis were astonished at the ease with which they had been able, in fact, by the summer of 1933, to come to dominate the media, to come to control the police, the courts, and by July 14, 1933, to ban all other political parties. End of 1933, there were really only two institutions that were of potential trouble in terms of the possibility of organizing resistance to the regime. The most important of those two was the army. The army had remained, on the one hand, attracted by the NSDAP. Hitler had made it clear that he planned to break the Treaty of Versailles, that he was going to reintroduce conscription, that he was going to build the army back to its position of respect in Germany. But the army also was nervous about the NSDAP, particularly nervous about the SA. The army, as you'll recall, had been restricted by the Treaty of Versailles to 100,000 troops. The SA, by the conclusion of 1932, had over 500,000 members, or they claimed to have 500,000. In the early months of 1933, the membership of the SA skyrocketed, so that by the summer and fall of 1933, it is estimated that the SA had over 1 million members. So the army was nervous. The traditional officer corps had been nervous about the proletarian elements, the radical elements of the NSDAP, and what they were concerned about was the possibility that the army would simply be absorbed by the SA. So the army remained a source of potential opposition to the regime, and a serious source of potential opposition. The second was the church, the Catholic Church in particular, though by late 1933, the concordat with the Vatican had by and large brought the church into the National Socialist fold. Still, at the end of 1933, tensions between the SA and the state, the Nazi state, had begun to mount. Ernst Röhm, the head of the SA and his top leadership, had taken quite seriously the National Socialist rhetoric about bringing about a social revolution. And as the spring turned into summer of 33, it became increasingly clear the regime was moving very slowly, that the sort of social revolution, the nationalization of the department stores, the smashing of interest slavery, and so on, had not taken place. The SA had been absolutely essential, as we know, in the seizure of power. But once the major potential opposition had been removed, the SA became increasingly an embarrassment to Hitler and a source of real friction. The Nazis, now in control of the state, particularly people like Frick, who was as Minister of the Interior, now with opposition broken, wanted to stabilize the situation, whereas the SA remained still this very revolutionary band. Moreover, within the SA, there was growing resentment. Why was the party now dragging its feet? Hitler was in power. Why weren't the radical promises of the party being fulfilled? In addition, there was another problem, and it was that by the summer of 1933, the old guard of the party was being swamped by an absolute tidal wave of new members. People now began joining the party for all sorts of reasons. It is estimated that by the end of 1933, over 80% of Nazi party members had joined since January 30th. A lot of people joined for opportunistic reasons, if one wanted to practice law, if one wanted to get ahead in business. It was generally seen the safe thing to do was to join. Some people obviously joined out of conviction. A great many more, I think, out of opportunistic considerations. What this meant was that for the SA, and for those members that had joined the party during the Kampfzeit, the period of struggle before 33, these new people were seen as not really committed National Socialists. And the resentment in the SA was particularly high because these new members, in many cases, filled leadership positions within the new regime. Moreover, the SA, and particularly Röhm, began talking quite publicly about absorbing the army. And this was something that both the army and Hitler were concerned about. Indeed, Röhm's intentions with regard to the army was causing Hitler increasing trouble by the end of 1933. Hitler feared that the army might actually take steps to overthrow the regime and restore the monarchy. Our old friend Franz von Papen, vice chancellor, continued to conduct discussions with various old line aristocrats about the possibility somehow of bringing back the Hohenzollerns. So Hitler's concern mounted in late 1933 and continued into early 1934, particularly when it became clear that Reich President Hindenburg was now gravely ill. What would happen when Hindenburg was removed from the scene? How would the army react without Hindenburg there as a stabilizing force, binding the army to the regime? In this situation, Hitler commissioned Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, the Schutzstaffel, an elite organization that we'll talk about in detail in just a moment. Hitler authorized Himmler to begin an investigation of Röhm. Röhm had been a very controversial figure before 1933. Charges of homosexuality directed against Röhm and other leaders of the SA. These were followed now with great vigor by Himmler and his SS officials. They gathered information on Röhm and the SA, and particularly presented a picture of Röhm as being extraordinarily ambitious, dangerous, and a possible revolutionary threat to the regime itself. In December of 33, Hitler, in a very public announcement, had said to a gathering of party officials, "The National Socialist Revolution is over." It was an attempt to allay the fears and concerns of the traditional elites of Germany, the army and in business, but it certainly didn't play very well with Röhm and the SA. As a consequence, the file prepared by Himmler was quite thick on incautious statements made now by Röhm and a number of his top lieutenants. Hitler met secretly with top army officials and made it clear to them that he was prepared to take action against Röhm and the SA leadership. Early on June 30th, 1934, Hitler himself appeared in Munich and moved on to a resort hotel on the island of Wiese, where SA leaders had been gathered for a retreat. Röhm was arrested, a number of SA top leaders taken into custody, and summarily executed in what came to be known as the Night of Long Knives. Top SA officials were killed, along with General Schleicher, the last pre-Hitler Chancellor of Germany. Gregor Strasser, the old second-in-command of the NSDAP, was also killed in the Night of Long Knives. Papen was earmarked for execution, but somehow escaped and would go on to be ambassador to Austria a bit later on. Papen was one of those people who had as many lives as a cat. It's estimated that about 150 people, all top leaders of the SA, or people, influential people in some cases, who had it one way or another crossed Hitler, were killed in the Night of Long Knives. It was clearly a bow to the military. It was a signal to them that when push came to shove, Hitler had clearly chosen, and it was a remarkable choice. He had chosen not the elite organization that had been so pivotal in establishing Nazi control in Germany in 1933, but had gone back to a traditional pillar of the German state, the German army. Hitler, in public, justified the executions of Röhm comrades by claiming that there was evidence that Röhm and the SA had planned a coup. The evidence was quite thin. But nonetheless, Röhm was planning a coup, Hitler argued, and it was necessary to take this extraordinary action. And then in the step that is absolutely symptomatic of the National Socialist perversion of justice by 1934, a law was passed on July 3rd, which retroactively sanctioned the murders, declaring them legal as an extraordinary action necessary for the defense of the German state. It was a complete perversion of any sort of notion of justice. Nonetheless, the army and industry were pleased by this purge of the SA. It indicated to them that Hitler was perhaps not as radical as they had feared, and that he had clearly chosen this traditional elite rather than his own elite organization. On August 2nd, 1934, in the immediate aftermath of the Night of Long Knives, Hindenburg died. Hitler, in a departure from even the enabling law, took the title now of Führer and Reich Chancellor, and the army was forced to swear a personal oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler. The oath that the army would swear following the death of Hindenburg was the quid pro quo for the Röhm purge. The army now had sworn its allegiance not to the German state, not to the Third Reich in any sort of abstraction, but rather to Adolf Hitler personally. This would play an important role for army officers in the high command a bit later on. The real winner of the Röhm purge of the SA was the SS, the Schutzstaffel, or the protective staff, quite literally translated, headed by Heinrich Himmler. The SS had been founded in 1925 as a personal bodyguard for Hitler, but it quickly evolved into an elite formation of the party and assumed duty as a sort of party security police during the Weimar Republic. The SS, in addition to providing protection for Hitler, took on the function of trying to ferret out spies, police spies, communist spies within the NSDAP, of which there were many, I might add, and also to begin gathering lists of enemies or potential enemies of the party. In 1931, Himmler established the so-called security service, the Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, as a secret police to watch over the party itself and its enemies. This new office was headed by a man named Reinhard Heydrich, who would play a pivotal role in what we've come to understand as the Holocaust. The rise of the SS was also directly tied to Heinrich Himmler's own political maneuverings in 1933 and in early 1934, in what was really one of the most extraordinary and revealing episodes of the Third Reich. The SS would come to be one of the central institutions of Nazi Germany. It would be the police force of the new regime, and it would come to be a formation which would carry out the terrible ideological goals of the NSDAP, particularly after the outbreak of the war. And yet, when one traces how the SS came to have this position in 1933-34, it's remarkable. Himmler was originally placed in charge of the political police in the state of Bavaria. That was his only official position other than being head of the SS in 1933. Acting on his own initiative, without any sort of authorization from Berlin, without any sort of authorization from party headquarters or from Hitler personally, Himmler simply went from Bavaria to the various German states, talked to the new police officials in those states, and basically convinced them to allow him to coordinate their police activities under SS leadership. Here was a case of personal initiative on Himmler's part, where he assiduously worked to acquire control over these police functions in these different German states. In Prussia, the political apparatus was under the control of Hermann Göring, who resisted Himmler. This is quite, what you begin to see is the NSDAP was not this tremendously hierarchically organized, efficient organization. There was a lot of jealousy, a lot of competition among leading figures of the party, which is something that Hitler himself liked to encourage. Göring resisted Himmler's efforts to move in on control of the Prussian police initially. Göring in April had transformed the old political police, the sort of German equivalent of the FBI, into a new organization, the so-called secret state police, the Geheime Staatspolizei, the acronym for which was Gestapo, and he gave this new organization broad police powers to root out subversion. He also ordered the establishment of Gestapo offices all over the Reich. Göring did this. He had no legal authority to do it. He simply established his own Gestapo in Prussia, where he was legally an official, and then, acting on his own initiative, established these Gestapo offices around the country. These new Gestapo offices typically were not to be subordinate to the state authorities in Baden or in Thuringia or in Bavaria, but would report directly to Goering. In 1934, after the purge of Röhm and the top SA leadership, these Gestapo offices were at last placed under the centralized direction of Himmler, who merged them with the SS. So it is in 1934 that one finally gets police control concentrated in the hands of the SS. The SS then would become a central feature, a central pillar of the new National Socialist regime of the Third Reich. In 1936, Himmler would take the title of Reichsführer SS and became officially chief of the German police, so that all police forces in Germany were now subordinated to the jurisdiction of the SS. It is a police network that was extraordinary in its breadth and in its ambition. These features of the new state were then in place. By late 1934, what one sees is the Gestapo in place, the SS has taken on these police functions. The National Socialist regime had become something quite different than it had appeared in early 1933. It had taken on the form of what we have come to think of as a totalitarian regime. But what do we mean by totalitarian? What is it? Certainly one aspect of totalitarian regimes is the combination of ideology and terror, a system built on ideology and terror. I think one of the most difficult things for Americans to come to terms with, not simply about the National Socialist phenomenon, but with world politics, is the notion of ideological politics, that there are people out there who will kill you for the sake of an idea. Certainly in this movement, and Hannah Arendt, in her great book from the 1950s, The Origins of Totalitarianism, developed these ideas and developed the model of totalitarianism. She argued that what separates a totalitarian party or a totalitarian regime from simply an authoritarian regime is a belief in an ideological vision of the world in which one believes that one's discovered the key to the human past and the human future. For the Bolsheviks under Stalin, she argued this was the ownership of the means of production, dialectical materialism. For the Nazis, as we will see, it would be race. That armed with this key to history, the totalitarian party sees itself as standing at a turning point in human history. That armed with this key to history, it is the obligation, the historical obligation of the party to act, to implement that ideology. That if it fails, then it has committed a tremendous historical sin. If this means trampling over traditional bourgeois notions of morality, if it means taking extraordinary action, the killing of children, women, and other innocent people, so be it. These may be crimes in the short term, these totalitarian movements would argue, but the great judge is, of course, the course of history and the ideological truth which they possess. So a commitment to an ideology and a ruthlessness about trying to implement that ideology would become characteristic. At the same time, these movements, upon seizing power, establish not only ideological reinforcement, indoctrination of their subjects, but also create a system of terror to hold the population in place. Certainly one sees this with the emergence of the SS and the Gestapo in Germany. Moreover, in a totalitarian regime, and it is from this in the sense that the term was derived, the claim of the state or the regime or the party is to the total person. Totalitarian regimes, so the argument goes, do not recognize a distinction between your public and your private life. In authoritarian regimes, if you do what you're told, you obey the law, you keep your nose clean, you keep your head down, you put out the flag on the Duce's birthday in Italy, for example, then your chances of getting by are perfect, are okay. A totalitarian regime, however, demands not only compliance with the law in an objective sense, but also seeks to reach out and control your private life as well. The distinction, the dividing line between public and private is erased. The claim of the regime is to the total person. This kind of system was clearly what was unfolding in Germany after 1933. And yet, if we have the image of a highly centralized state apparatus, dominated by party ideologues who determine policy and then see it executed efficiently by sending orders down a very highly recognizable chain of command, we're in for something of a surprise with Nazi Germany. Because as historians have had access to documents to see how the state in Germany actually functioned after 1933, a very, very different picture has emerged over the past decade plus of research. Historians of Nazi Germany have come to describe the regime not as a highly efficient or organized sort of power structure, but rather as, quote, organized chaos, or, quote, institutional Darwinism, a combination of this totalitarian claim and an extraordinarily fluid organizational structure. For one thing, in Nazi Germany, offices multiplied. Hitler never engaged after the Röhm purge in any sort of major purge of top officials. One doesn't see the equivalent of the sort of purge trials of the late 30s in the Soviet Union. Instead, when somebody fell out of favor with Hitler or somebody failed to get the job done, rather than being fired, what Hitler would do would be typically to create simply an ad hoc organization to do the same job. So that what one found were competing jurisdictions, several agencies of government and the party charged with absolutely the same task. Overlapping jurisdiction, organizational confusion. The question was this a conscious plan on Hitler's part to control the situation, to increase his own personal power, or was this simply his own personal style? The more we've discovered about Hitler's, I guess what we would call decision-making tendencies and proclivities, the more we've come to believe that rather than a conscious plan, what we were seeing is the workings of Hitler's own personal style. Until the death of Hindenburg, Hitler kept fairly regular cabinet, held cabinet meetings regularly. He made an effort to be at the Reich Chancellery, at his office in the morning, to hold regular appointments with state officials and so on. He actually even signed documents in this period, something he was not wont to do thereafter. After Hindenburg's death in August of 1934, however, the cabinet did not meet regularly, and after 1938, the cabinet never met at all in Germany. Ministers of government were now forbidden to meet informally and were forced to submit all of their draft legislation to the secretary of the Reich Chancellery, a man by the name of Hans Lammers, who would read these things before submitting them to Hitler. Only when all issues had been resolved and some sort of consensus reached was business taken to Hitler. The same was true of the party. The Gauleiter, the regional chieftains of the party, were also forbidden to meet outside of Hitler's presence. They were also, Hitler refused to meet with them on any issue unless there was unanimity. He didn't want to be in a position where he had to choose between one of his lieutenants and another. As a consequence, the Gauleiter could come together and meet with Hitler only when all differences had been resolved. The man who was in charge of making sure that these things were resolved was the Hitler's secretary for the party, and that was Rudolf Hess. Later, it would be a man by the name of Martin Bormann. Hence, there was no real party hierarchy or organization. The key to success in Nazi Germany was access to Hitler. And that meant getting through Lammers in the Reich Chancellery office or through Rudolf Hess, i.e. Bormann, through the party chancellery. One of the few instances, I think, where the sort of Hollywood depiction of the Third Reich is accurate is when you see, these depictions of Hitler at his summer home, his home, the Berghof in Bavaria, or elsewhere, and you see the sort of retinue of Nazi officials running after him, trying to be around him at all times. This was absolutely essential, because after August of 34, Hitler rarely showed up at the office. Indeed, it was very difficult to find out where he was going to be at all. This made him, obviously, the final arbiter of all issues. But since Hitler kept increasingly idiosyncratic hours and moved from place to place, it made government extremely difficult. Hitler hated Berlin. He never forgave the city for being so pro-communist and pro-social democratic. He spent a great deal of time at his house in the Alps, just outside of Berchtesgaden. He also spent a good deal of time at the party building, his official residence in Munich, and moved from place to place. He also was a man who didn't like to be burdened with bureaucratic obligations, so that his day would begin quite late, around 11 o'clock in the morning, where he would come in for about an hour, see various people. He would lunch from 12 to 2, take a little nap after that, would have official business again late in the afternoon for an hour and a half, 2 hours, again have another evening meal, and then would entertain his cronies with stories from the comic side or so on, and then would adjourn to the projection room where he would watch movies until 2 or 3 in the morning, often American entertainment movies. Big popular entertainment films from the 1930s. It became extremely difficult to see the man, to get through to the man, and he had a terrible tendency, as Heths and Lammers quickly discovered, of saying yes to the last person he met. If you could get in to see Hitler, you had a pet project, you wanted something done, what you did was to try to get to see him, get through to him, spew out your project quickly. Hitler would be inclined to say, yes, 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 of course, and then go on. Then what you would do is to go back to your region and to say, I'm operating on the basis of a Führer order. Hitler gave verbal commands. He virtually never committed himself to paper, and particularly after 1934. This is extremely important when we think a bit later about trying to follow the so-called paper trail during the events leading to the Holocaust, and of course to this ludicrous notion that Adolf Hitler could have kept secret diaries. The man simply did not write things down. This meant that offices multiplied, competencies overlapped both within the party and within the government. People were given okays from Hitler to do all kinds of special projects. Special commissions, special ad hoc offices were created. This would come back to haunt the regime later on when, in the early years of the war, indeed down to the end of 1944, there were no fewer than 5 different offices charged with the economic planning of the German war effort. So when something as central as that, one sees this organized chaos. Hitler didn't care to intervene too directly in local or regional affairs as long as basic policy was being executed. Hitler liked to see himself as a big picture man. He didn't want to be bothered by the details. He wanted to be able to sort of outline the general direction of policy and then was perfectly happy to let the different Gauleiter, the regional party chieftains or state officials, struggle with one another to see how best to implement it. One sees this over and over again in the Third Reich. Conflicts between party and state simply had to resolve themselves. Hitler rarely intervened. Just to give you one example, Frick, the Minister of the Interior, by April of 1933, was trying to bring some sort of order into the chaos in Germany with the SA running around arresting people, setting up these concentration camps that we've mentioned yesterday. What he wanted to do was to make it clear that the SA was subject to the law, especially since the Nazis were now in control of the law. Therefore, Frick pushed through a law which stated quite explicitly that the SA and the SS were subject to the law. That he, Frick, was, as the top administrator of the law, would be in charge. This law was simply ignored by Himmler. He couldn't be bothered with it. When Frick would say, you know, you have to, you know, your men have to follow the legal guidelines that we've set down, Himmler's response was basically, make me. I'm following the Führer. I know what the Führer wants, and I'm following his line of command. Hitler did not intervene. When Frick pushed for normalization of the legal situation, declaring that the revolution was over, as Hitler himself had said, the various regional chieftains and Himmler simply ignored this kind of order. This was quite typical of the Third Reich. The regional chieftains of the party acted, by and large, like medieval feudal vassals working within the party hierarchy. Hitler stood above these conflicts, which, of course, made his influence the critical factor, and he was always careful to keep his orders quite vague. Hitler, a typical Führer order, would be a very general kind of order, and then his underlings had to try to figure out exactly what the will of the Führer meant, how best to implement it. It left regional and local leaders in government to, quote, interpret the will of the Führer. We have many examples of Gauleiter, these regional chieftains, simply ignoring direct orders from Berlin, in some cases even ignoring a Hitler order. For example, in April of 1933, the party had declared a national boycott, we'll talk about this in the next session, of Jewish businesses. That boycott proved to be a fiasco, was called off after about a day, for reasons we'll talk about again in a moment. And yet, in the area around Nuremberg, the boycott simply went on, even though an order had been given to halt it. Why? The Gauleiter of Upper Franconia, a particularly vicious man named Julius Streicher, argued that it wasn't necessary for him to rescind the boycott because he knew what Hitler really wanted, and Hitler really wanted the boycott to continue, but he couldn't say so in public. That Hitler didn't intervene, didn't call him on the carpet, and the boycott went on there. Albert Speer, who can't be believed about a great many things in his various autobiographical works, I think one has to take with tremendous caution and skepticism, can be trusted, I think, about one thing, and that's his description of the way the regime functioned. Speer would be the man who would actually bring these various economic organizations of the regime under control during the course of the war. And he stated here, and I'll quote, "The constitutional forms of our organization were just as improvised and vague as all these arrangements. There were no precise statement. There was no precise statement of my assignments or jurisdiction. My feeling was that I was better off without such definitions. I did my best to keep the situation fluid." Close quote. A bit later on, he, in talking to Hitler in 1942 about his economic organization, he again would say, and I quote, "Whenever I explained my organizational plans to Hitler, he showed a striking lack of interest. I had the impression that he did not like to deal with these questions. Indeed, in certain realms, he was altogether incapable of distinguishing the important from the unimportant. He also didn't like establishing clear lines of jurisdiction. Sometimes he deliberately assigned bureaus or individuals the same or similar tasks. That way, he used to say, the stronger gets the job done." This kind of organizational chaos or institutional Darwinism would be the central organizing principle of the Third Reich. Now, if the Third Reich from above looked like organized chaos, it looked quite different if you were at the bottom, if you were an average citizen of the Third Reich. The chaos seemed calculated. Indeed, it created uncertainty, confusion. People were left with no fixed points of orientation. There was no reality by 1934 that was not a National Socialist reality. No way of seeing one's opinions reflected in the national media. The media dominated events, and there was a never-ending round of official Nazi activities. The celebration of the Führer's birthday in April, the celebration of the great beer hall putsch in November, the celebration of Horst Wessel's death, the celebration of the party rally in September in Nuremberg, a week-long event, which was the highlight of the National Socialist social season. All of these things, over and over again, almost no week could pass in National Socialist Germany without there being some official holiday. Moreover, social life was now organized, not simply the major institutions of government and the economy. Children were organized into the Hitler Youth for boys, or the Bund Deutscher Mädel, the League of German Girls for young girls. The National Socialist Women's Organization, the Nationalsozialistische Frauenschaft. There was a National Socialist Students League, a National Socialist Teachers Organization, a National Socialist Attorneys League. My favorite one is the National Socialist Barbers League, the slogan for which was, "Barbers too face great tasks." All of these organizations had their own little party badge, many of them, especially the youth organizations, uniforms, meetings, badges, flags, slogans. What one saw was the Nazification of virtually every aspect of German society and the militarization of German life as well. Sporting clubs, choral societies, the local football leagues, all were absorbed by this National Socialist regime. What one was witnessing was the atomization of society. From the labor unions to social clubs, German social life was becoming atomized as the party infiltrated virtually all areas of social interaction. People spoke less freely, social life grew less open. Even within the family unit, children were encouraged to report on their parents if they heard something that sounded subversive. The breakdown between public and private spheres was slowly becoming the norm. What one said at home, what one thought were important, were as important as what one actually did. One could be brought in, or could be suspected not only of objective crimes, something one had actually done, but subjective crimes, things that were merely thought, and in a particularly pernicious development. Laws were applied retroactively in some cases, so that if one had, quote, social democratic leanings in 1932, one could be brought in and interrogated by the SS as a result of anti-community opinions. Neighbors, family members were subtly encouraged to inform on one another. Each building, each city block had its own Blockwart, a special National Socialist representative who made sure that the residents of his building put out the flag on the Führer's birthday and that each listened to the radio over the new, the Volkssender, the new people's radio that the Nazis produced in mass numbers and sold so that the speeches of the Führer could be broadcast nationally. People now could be arrested for being anti-community minded, taken into protective custody, or they might be released after an hour or so, but you can imagine the effect. Since arrests, the Gestapo found, were much more effective if they occurred at night, rumor and fear mounted. One didn't dare ask too many questions or state outrage too openly, maybe even in one's own family. There's a marvelous play by Bertolt Brecht, who left Germany shortly after the outset of the Third Reich. I think the English title is called The Private Life of the Master Race, in which it's a series of little vignettes, little scenes, one of which is a mother and father talking over breakfast, and the father is sort of grousing because, you know, there's margarine instead of butter. And he's saying, you know, I thought in the Third Reich, in the glorious Third Reich, the Führer was going to provide and we wouldn't be eating margarine. I think his wife says, well, you know, we just don't have it. We can't get it at the stores. So they finally decide to send little Fritz or Hans or whatever his name is, the son, off to the local store to see if he can't get some milk that morning. So their son is gone for a while, and they continue to talk, the father complaining about the situation. And then little Fritz doesn't come back, and he doesn't come back, and he doesn't come back. And finally they said, where's he gone? He said, plenty of time to get down to the store and back. Where could he be? Then the husband says, well, what were we talking about? And his wife says, well, you were complaining about the lack of butter in the Third Reich. Well, I wasn't complaining. I mean, it wasn't, I mean, you know, this wasn't a serious sort of thing. I mean, I'm true to the Führer. And the tension mounts around this breakfast table as they wait for little Fritz to come back to see whether he's gone to inform on his parents. The conclusion of the scene is that little Fritz does come back in. He's just dawdled on the way to and from the store. But I think the impact of the scene is quite clear. Many Germans looking back on the society, on the social reality of the Third Reich, don't so much remember overt fear, constantly looking over their shoulder for the Gestapo, but a kind of internalized fear, I think. Not an everyday awareness of the Gestapo, but a kind of fear that one did certain things in certain ways to avoid trouble. One went through, in many cases, one went through the motions. One put out the flag, turned on the radio. In many cases, what would happen is that people would put on the radio and put it beside the front door of the apartment, turn the radio up loud during Hitler's speech, and then go to another room of the house so that when the Blockwart came by and listened, he could hear that you were listening to the Führer's speech on the radio. People in many cases tried to live their lives quietly without attracting too much attention. There was a form of what many Germans remember as internal immigration, a leading of intensely private lives, but with perverted social interaction. A great many Germans, of course, were committed Nazis. Though one suspects from reading Gestapo reports, and then we have secret Gestapo reports of what they call Stimmung in der Bevölkerung, public opinion in effect, that the Gestapo didn't believe this was the case. What the Nazis counted on more than anything else was not a commitment to the ideological goals of National Socialism. The Nazis counted on apathy. They counted on people, each atomized person, looking out after his or her own interests and not bothering to take any other step. And if one had misgivings, if one were worried or one disagreed with the regime, one found little or no reinforcement. One couldn't really confide in friends, and there was very little organized discussion outside of official Nazi supervision. Would someone inform? You might tell a joke in a bar one day, and there were plenty of jokes going around, jokes like, yes, I'm an Aryan. I'm blonde like Hitler. I'm tall like Goebbels, who was about this tall. And I'm slender like Goering. You might tell a joke like this one night in a pub, and everybody burst out laughing. You might tell the joke in another pub the next night, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning, the Gestapo would knock on your door, and you'd be taken downtown for interrogation. You could never really tell. It was the unpredictability, the insecurity of it that was important. The And outside, of course, in the streets, the Nazis were reinforcing this with an extremely positive vision of what was going on. Law and order had been restored. Economic security and the promise of prosperity was on the way. Political stability. There were no more clashes in the streets. There was no more battling with the communists. And the sort of class conflict that had plagued the Weimar Republic seemed to be over. The Nazis had created what they called the Volksgemeinschaft, the people's community. Everything was Volks. The Volkssender, everybody should have a radio. The terms Mr. and Miss or Mrs. were dropped, and one was supposed to refer to one's neighbor as Volksgenosse, people's comrade so-and-so. And, of course, by 1937, the Nazis hit upon the idea that the people should have a car, and so they began to develop the Volkswagen, the people's car. Nonetheless, German society was undergoing a process of real revolution, a process of isolation, atomization, indoctrination, and diversion in a particularly sinister way. I'd like to conclude this first session. I know we're going on a bit long, but I'd like to conclude this first session with a fairly lengthy quote, if I may, from a very important book by Milton Mayer called They Thought They Were Free. Mayer went back to Germany as a Jew after the war and interviewed a number of everyday Germans for their responses and their descriptions of what life was like in the Third Reich. What I'm going to read you are excerpts from his chapter on From a University Teacher. It's lengthy, but I think it captures the essence of this process that I've been trying to describe. To live in this process, the school teacher remarked, is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me. Unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had occasion to develop, each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, and on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures that, quote, no patriotic German, close quote, could resent, must someday lead to, unless one saw where this was leading, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. One day it's over his head. Your little men, your Nazi friends, were not against National Socialism in principle. Men like me, who were, are the greater offenders. Not because we knew better, that would be saying too much, but because we sensed better. Pastor Niemöller spoke for the thousands and thousands of men like me when he spoke too modestly of himself and said that when the Nazis attacked the communists, he was uneasy, but after all, he was not a communist and he did nothing. And then they attacked the socialists, and he was a little uneasier, but still, he was not a socialist, and he did nothing. And then the schools, the press, the Jews, and so on, and he was always uneasier, and still he did nothing. And then they attacked the church, and he was a churchman, and he did something, but then it was too late. You see, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even to talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble. Why not? Well, you're not in the habit of doing it. And it's not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It's also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside in the streets, in the general community, everyone is happy. One hears no protests and one certainly sees none. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You're saying that this must lead to this and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes. But how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as a pessimist or even neurotic. You're left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller. Attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now in small gatherings of your old friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things, and this weakens your confidence. You wait for the one great shocking occasion, but the one great shocking occasion when tens of thousands will join you never comes. That's the difficulty. if the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and the smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 1943 had come immediately after the boycott of Jewish shops in 1933. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B. And if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you at step C, and so on to step D? And then one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Jew swine," collapses it all at once. And you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the mealtimes, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, has changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed.